This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
You're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. Everything Tom, Rich and I have been doing Thursday, May the 12th. That includes quite the chat about crypto and a lot of listener interaction in that. Ethereum falling below $2,000. We've been having the is it real or is it a Ponzi scheme debate on the Business Breakfast. And we've been speaking to a crypto expert, Matthew Dixon, to find out where prices could potentially go next. Are there fundamentals or is it just speculation? It's also been a number-filled day today. A lot of earnings, a lot of very good earnings, and a number of aviation experts telling us what's happening in their organisations. One includes Paul Griffiths, who came in with Q1 numbers for Dubai Airports, and Etihad Airways' Terry Daly, who gave us a bit of a heads up on what their Q1 might look like. I was distracted by the sheer... No, it was not Wordle. It was the sheer brutality of the crypto sell-off. Just to put in some kind of context for you how fast those prices are dropping. The top of the hour there, so 3 minutes ago, Rich, you said it was 2,000 and...
It was just above 2,000.
Okay.
That is no longer the case.
That is no longer the case. We are at 1955 at the moment. It's down 17% today.
It's pretty grim, isn't it? I'm getting my prices from Kraken, just because I like the word, the Kraken, because I like the Lego movie. Yeah, they're quoting 1,965 at the moment, but you're right. But literally, when I did the currency report 12 minutes ago, it was above 2,000. And it is not anymore. This is moving in real time. And it's quite brutal, which is why we've got a few crypto experts on this morning. We spoke earlier on to Matthew Dixon of eBay.io. They do ratings for different cryptocurrencies. A lot of people are invested in cryptos, rightly or wrongly. But even normal punters like you and I have bought some.
And that's just it. I mean, you're getting your numbers from Kraken. I'm getting it from various people who know that I bought in at 3,850. So... Okay.
If you needed evidence of that, look at our text messages today. Every single text message is about the crypto conversation this morning.
Yeah, a couple about, you're right. There's one or two about airports, but the vast majority, 85% plus, are people who either for it, against it, think it's rubbish, think we're not taking it seriously enough, whatever it is, they're talking crypto, aren't they?
Yeah, everyone's a piece of it.
I'm trying to figure out what I bought Mana at when we bought in Decentraland. When did we buy? It was February this year we bought into. Right now, Mana, which is the Decentraland currency, is 70 cents. We bought in February, middle of February, when it was... oh dear. About $3.
And here's the thing. No one really, really knows. And I know with Ethereum, there was the issue with the NFTs and everything with the release the other week. But no one really knows what... Didn't you buy Bitcoin in at 34,000?
I bought Bitcoin at 32. So I'm down a bit, but I'm all right. But I've been absolutely hammered on Mana.
But here's the thing. We've got lots of theories for why it's moving, but I would argue no one really knows. People keep talking about sentiment. No one is talking about fundamentals, really. I've heard theories that we're beginning to see it move in line with stock markets, hence sell-off in crypto, sell-off in stocks at the moment, because you've got some of the big boys, the big banks setting up crypto funds, etc. And because they're getting involved, we're seeing things move more in correlation with markets. I'm not sure I agree with that. We've got the whole it's an inflation hedge argument, which works until it starts falling off like a cliff like it is today. I don't think anyone actually knows what makes it move.
Well, and we've had investment professionals like Steve Bryce, chief investment strategist at Standard Chartered in Singapore, and a friend of the Business Breakfast, former Dubai resident. We asked him about it, and he said, look, there's just no methodology for valuing it. How can I value whether... there is no intrinsic value valuation model that I can use. I mean, I can for a Tesla stock. I can be right, I can be wrong, but at least there's a model. I can value a bond.
There's a car, isn't there? Actually, yeah. is yeah. what there is, let's be honest.
There's revenue streams, either oil, well, there's the utility of oil, the supply and demand, but with these things, it's very, very difficult. I mean, you could say the same thing about gold. There's no real intrinsic value of gold. So this is not unprecedented in investment terms, but it is difficult for the investment world to take a punt on it. But the exchange is falling as well. You know, these are the, if you think of Coinbase, if this is a gold rush, Coinbase is the main exchange for cryptos. There are many, but Coinbase is one of the biggies. And it listed on the stock market. It's a great fanfare late last year. In November last year, one share of Coinbase would have cost you $353. Today, it's just 53.
But I mean, and again, I was reading some commentary the other day comparing crypto to a gold rush, and they said the problem with gold rushes is you never really know if people are finding it and how much, because people talk a good game, or in this case, they buy a flashy Lamborghini. Look, no one, I think no one wants to be the one to call out that the emperor has no clothes on the crypto front.
Fair point. I'm not going to mention anything about.
I'm just saying.
Crypto interviews this morning and Ambrose having no clothes.
But no one wants to be the one to say, hang on. Because no one wants to be the one to say this wheel thing will never catch on. Horseless carts, you say? Do you know what I mean? You want to feel like you're down with the kids with it, that you're not the one who doesn't know how to work the VCR remote. You know what I mean?
He completely, yeah, internet, what nonsense. I read the Daily Telegraph, everything's fine. Why would I need an internet?
Yeah. Tom?
I think we're too far gone. I think it's been going on for far too long. And there's too much infrastructure now and too much interest for it to fail.
And it's not too big to fail.
I don't think it will fail. I think it is going to be something that everyone kicks their heels. I don't think it's going to be as big a money spinner as it has been for many people in recent years. But it will be, I feel, the future of, not finance per se, but it will be a large part of it because of the fundamentals, because of blockchain technology is going to be the way that things get done. Whether banks get cut out of the equation remains to be seen, but cryptos will play a part, and I think there is enough being done already. There's enough interest as well. It's something that hopefully we could talk about tomorrow, but, I mean, Chelsea have signed a deal with the crypto partner today or last night, $20 million deal for $20 million a year, £20 million sterling a year, not bad, for a cryptocurrency brand called Whalefin. Never heard of it before. It's going to be on the sleeve of Chelsea Football Club. Crypto.com, Miami Grand Prix, Formula One Grand Prix, cryptocurrency, official cryptocurrency, also signed up with the Football World Cup for this year. Big businesses like this, and I know crypto and sport have got that relationship at the moment because they want to get their brand out there as much as possible. But, you know, you don't get F1, you don't get FIFA, you don't get Chelsea signing up without a bit of due diligence done.
You say that, but if you go back to 97, 98, 99, who was sponsoring massive sports matches whose, you know, sort of logos were you seeing all around grounds? And it was dot-com companies.
Yeah.
Followed by a bust. And there is some theories out there that when you see the big sponsorships being taken over by new companies in the same sector, you are heading for a bit of a bubble.
Yeah, but you could make the argument also, couldn't you, that dot-com has continued.
Well, that the internet has continued. I'll give you that. I will give you that, Tom. The internet does still exist and make money. Isa is yelling in our ears that we have to speak to Serena Kelly and actually do some news.
No, you don't really, because I'm fascinated. I just went off on a complete tangent in my head thinking if I had NFT digital art, can I display it in the metaverse? But anyway, went off on one. Yeah. And you're not alone with the Ethereum. My sister was gifted Ethereum and it was like 2,000-3,000 a couple of months back. And now she was explaining how she's disappointed that it's dropped and it's only.
She didn't pay for it.
No, I know, but it's 187. Because she's trying, she wants to like cash it in so she can pay for the rest of her masters. But anyway,
That's worthy.
But yeah, I was just thinking you're not alone with Ethereum.
This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Paul is here for the numbers this morning. Dubai Airport's just on the maths on its first quarter traffic. And he's in the studio to share them with us. The CEO of Dubai Airport's, Paul Griffiths. Good morning.
Good morning, Brandy.
So how was that first quarter for you, Paul?
Well, pretty good, actually, considering where we've been over the last couple of years. We recorded 13.6 million passengers in the first quarter, which is the highest quarterly traffic we've had since 2020, and up 15.7 compared to the 11.8 million we had in Q4 2021. So good numbers, but let's remember we're not quite back to pre-pandemic levels yet. The direct traffic's recovered magnificently, and we're actually more than 100% where we were in terms of traffic to and from Dubai. But some of those transfer markets, particularly Australasia and Asia, still a little sluggish as they recover from the pandemic. We're about sort of 50% recovered in those transfer markets. So there's a lot of scope for growth in those over the next few months. But our end of year projection now, something like 58.3 million passengers, up from the 57 million we were projecting a few months ago. So I think good news all round, really.
Let's dig into that in a little bit more detail. We're not at pre-pandemic levels. Overall, what percentage are we at the moment?
Probably around the sort of 57, 58% total, something like that.
Of what we would have been if this had never happened.
Total traffic, yes, that's right. Remember, in about 2018, we were recording close to 90 million passengers a year. So if we're projecting 58.3, there's still a little bit of recovery to go after yet. But I'm quite optimistic that we were originally saying pre-pandemic levels by 2025. That's likely to be closer to 24 now. We're projecting something like 85.7 recovery to in 2024.
And you were talking there about the difference between the point-to-point traffic, people going straight from A to B, and people using Dubai as a hub. Why is that second lot so important?
Well, it's very important because most of the routes on which we're able to operate from DXB do require the support of both point-to-point and transfer traffic to be viable. So having those markets beyond Dubai in all directions gives us many, many thousands of city pair combinations, which make us the most competitive and the largest international hub in the world. So it's very vital to have those markets back. But I think during the pandemic, because of the amazing job the health authority and the government did here to just get the message out there that Dubai was never closed and we were welcoming people to the safety and the wonderful weather and the beaches of Dubai, we did a great job and we've actually extended the reputation and market share in the point-to-point market magnificently.
So people coming just to Dubai for Dubai's sake?
That's correct, yes.
We've got China still in lockdown in a number of major cities. We've got the war in Ukraine. What do both of those mean for you as an airport?
Well, clearly, the markets in Asia, particularly China, obviously Australasia's back, which is good. New Zealand, we're waiting for recovery. Hopefully, those markets will give us some growth and recovery in the transfer markets. Obviously, the war in Ukraine's causing a few circuitous routings on flights to particularly the west coast of the US. And obviously the overall sentiment is not great. But we're in that very interesting period at the moment where airlines have cut back their capacity, retired the older aircraft. So there is a bit of a capacity pinch at the moment. But and passenger demand, of course, after having 3.9 billion people in some form of lockdown over the last couple of years, people are willing to travel and willing to pay for it. So we've got quite an unusual situation, which is obviously going to stabilise over time.
Which seems to be being reflected in load factors as well. I mean, if I look at your figures, people going through the airport up around 15%, planes going through the airport just up 6%.
That's right. Load factor has been actually a large part of the improvement. 70% we're at now, which is pretty high compared to where we were before. And I think the thing is, on our principal markets, India, the UK, Pakistan, Saudi, traffic has actually climbed hugely in the last few months. So it's those traditional routes that are giving us, I think, that growth.
And yet we've got cargo down around 15% on the quarter before. What does that tell us about the bigger picture, Paul, about the world economy?
Well, I think, again, that's a slightly unusual situation because cargo has been really gangbusters through the whole pandemic as lots of the major shipping routes were very constrained in capacity. So I think that cargo had to come off a little bit, but I think we'll still continue to be strong. We'll get back to the normal levels we had pre-pandemic soon. But I think it's to be expected that the massive rise we had in cargo through the pandemic, when a lot of the major ways of shipping goods around the world were not available, that was really booming. And of course, as we know, a lot of airlines converted a lot of their passenger planes to cargo. Those are now being put back to passenger configuration, so capacity is coming out of the cargo market. So I'm not surprised at all at the figures, and it's not a cause of concern.
So we've got this boom in passengers at the moment, and yet you pulled quite the face when I gave you the fuel price there, $142.50. Is there a point of demand destruction if the fuel price keeps rising?
Well, you see, there isn't, unfortunately, and I'm sure a lot of airline people will agree with me. There isn't a straight relationship between airline pricing and fuel cost. Otherwise, airlines would be consistently profitable. The problem is, of course, rising fuel prices put a lot of pressure on the cost structure of airlines. Fuel is usually the largest single cost that an airline has to carry. So when oil prices go up, it's much harder for airlines to continue to make a profit. And at the moment, because of that bubble of excess demand and constrained supply, fortunately, airline pricing, I think, as we've all experienced, is pretty high at the moment. So they're able to cover the cost. But if in the long term, oil prices remain high, that is a threat to the profitability of airlines in the longer term.
We've got 1 minute left with you, Paul. What does all of this mean for your outlook for the airport this year? What are you now forecasting?
Well, I think by the end of the year, we've revised our forecast. It's now 58.3 million passengers for 2022, which I think is a much improved position. For 2023, we're thinking about 75 million and 2024, 85.7. So I think it means that within the next 2-3 years, we'll be back to pre-pandemic levels. And we're already thinking of how we invest in the future of the airport, improving the quality of the passenger experience. And our aim, as always, is not just to be the maths of the biggest airport, but our customers voting us to be the best airport, which they did the other night when we got the best airport in the world from Business Traveller. So thanks to everyone that voted for us. And I just hope that that continues to be the experience that people get when they use DXB and DWC, of course.
Paul Griffiths, CEO of Dubai Airports, in the studio this morning, sharing those Q1 numbers with us. We do love people who give us numbers first. Busiest quarter since 2020, 13.6 million passengers, and the second quarter in a row to pass the 10 million mark. Thank you, Paul.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Going to bring in now Matthew Dixon, who's the founder and CEO of eVay.io. He is a crypto expert. Matthew, good morning. Thanks very much indeed for being with us.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So talk me through the past 48 hours or so. We've had Terra, a stablecoin, falling by as much as 60 or even 70%. We've had Coinbase, one of, if not the main crypto exchanges, shares down 28% overnight. And Bitcoin, as you just heard, below $30,000. What happened?
I think we've got to look at this in terms of the overall macroeconomic environment. I mean, obviously Luna, you know, Terra and the UST is a specific case. But if we look at the overall macroeconomic environment, we can see that inflation is becoming a problem worldwide. Although these are external factors driven by the likes of the war in Ukraine and with Russia. We've also got problems of falling growth around the world. And the fact they're now having to raise interest rates. So we saw the Fed raise rates. In fact, we've seen rates being rising around the world, the central banks raising rates. Now, this affects risk assets. Cryptocurrency, we have to remember, is just another risk asset. And so it is affected by these macroeconomic factors. So people need to understand that cryptocurrency is not immune from these things and will be affected. And so we've been expecting this for a long time at eVay.io. We obviously follow, we have a multi-factor rating system, and we've been following the market and predicting that there's going to be a very substantial correction. And as you said earlier in the piece, it may not be over yet. So overall, that's the overall picture. But we can obviously talk more specifically about Luna, about Terra Luna and the issues there.
Yeah, well, let's do that, because you're essentially a ratings agency. I mean, you're not Standard & Poor's, but you offer ratings on different cryptocurrencies, don't you? And you have a rating scale. So if we look at what's top of your rating scale at the moment, the cryptos that score well on your rating scale and the ones that do not so well, and what's the difference between them, Matthew?
Okay, when you say, I mean, we're certainly not Standard & Poor's, because we've pioneered the world's first unbiased rating system. And by that, we don't actually get paid by the companies that we rate. So we use a multi-factor system, which is based on probably the last 50 or 60 years worth of academic learning from Nobel Prize winners like Fama and French. And then we couple that with the latest technology with artificial intelligence and machine learning to gather all of the data. And that's impossible with a human mind these days, to gather so much data and then use that data to come up with a rating. So you'll see, you know, if you checked on the website, eBay.io, you will see that we rate different currencies. And the ratings change depending on market conditions, but also depending on these multiple factors. We look at risk and, you know, sentiment, and we use 9 different factors. And within each factor, many different indices, indicators, and so on within the factors. So it's quite a complex system, and that's why we need the artificial intelligence. And you'll see that some, you know, there are still, even in this terrible market, there's one or two you can pick out have maintained a higher rating and performed. Even yesterday, there's one I looked at and managed a 6% return in the day. But all in all, the ratings have turned down. We have a global rating measurement, and yeah, the whole market is tanking at the moment. But this was expected. We anticipated this, and that's the power of an unbiased rating system. It provides and empowers people to make better investment decisions.
No, it's fascinating stuff, and I'm looking at it now. Your ratings go from A1, which is the top rating, down to U. And so when we say you're not Standard & Poor's, I mean, there's a ratings methodology there that I recognise from the Moody's and the S&P's of this world in terms of A1, A2, B2, B3, and so on and so forth. Bitcoin, you rate, is it C at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, these ratings were actually, I mean, we developed our MVP, which came out May of last year, and we've been moving forward since then. So these ratings are relatively short term, but actually that really does empower traders to make better investment decisions. We're also just about to roll out a classification model, which looks more at true underlying value. And on that scale, you might see Bitcoin ranked more highly. But at the moment, this is really empowers traders to make investment decisions. So at the moment, even Bitcoin, which is the grandfather of them all, it's an amazing technology, blockchain technology, which will change the world, the commercial world. But even Bitcoin, from a trading perspective, obviously you said just earlier, it's 28,000 and something at the moment. It's fallen from a high of, well, in the high 60,000s. So it's fallen massively. So from a trading perspective, this really gives you the information that you need in terms of, is it a good investment at the moment?
And it's down at C3, which is one of your lowest ratings. We're short of time, Matthew. Couple of final questions. 30 seconds on this. Top of your ratings at the moment, A3, Napoleonks. Never heard of it. What's that?
Well, the thing about them is that we actually rate, there's 18,000 cryptocurrencies out there. So most people have not heard of any of them. And that's why it's so important to have a machine learning. You couldn't do this with human, you know, human, the power of a human mind. The ratings technology can rate thousands of different cryptocurrencies. We currently rate 1,200 of them. And that's what's so good about it. It can pick out the needles in the haystack that are those great investment opportunities. So if you look at the performance, the upgrades of those particular assets, you'll see they do well even in a terrible market. And that's what you can't do manually. It's got to be done in an automated and unbiased way, and that's what we're doing. So we can pick out those unheard of assets, the needles in the haystack, that are the real gems that crypto investors are looking for.
Well, the top three, Napoleonics at number one, then you've got TokenPay And at number three on your rankings at the moment looks like Feathercoin with a B1 rating. I'm going to be looking at this in more detail. But for now, Matthew, appreciate your time this morning. I'm sure we'll speak again. Matthew Dixon is the founder and the CEO of evi.io.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Speaking of numbers, Etihad has not released its numbers yet. I was speaking at ATM to Terry Daly, who's the Executive Director of Guest Experience at Etihad, and he said that he couldn't give me figures. We were talking about the kind of recovery, obviously, that Etihad has seen from the pandemic. So he couldn't give me actual numbers, Rich, but he could tell me how it was going. And as you've just heard there in our headline, the going is pretty good.
Traffic has come back really strongly in this first quarter of the year, and way stronger than I think any of us were predicting midway through last year. It's almost like a fire hydrant. Our load factors, yesterday for instance, 83% load factor across our network, which is really up at pre-COVID type levels. So a really good start to the year. Probably the best quarter financially that Etihad has ever had.
And what's he putting that down to? To explain, Terry gave me a bit of a history lesson.
Well, if you wind back to 2017, and we remember the strategy that Etihad was on, which was a pretty challenging one and not exactly yielding profit, and a new team brought in, and Tony Douglas coming in, and a number of us being part of the team, we were on a transformation program already. As a number of us have said, I think in beginning of 2020, at that point we'd had our best ever quarter, and we're sitting back thinking, what could go wrong? And of course then all hell broke loose with COVID. So we're already on a transformation program, and the whole aim of that was to return the company to profitability by 2023. That was the target. Now, COVID has been a real challenge for everyone, but it also produces opportunities. And it enabled us to really focus in on our business and to accelerate some of our program to the point where it will need a bit of a fair wind this year, the whole world not falling apart, but there's a chance we could deliver early on the profitability target, which I think would be a remarkable achievement.
When could you potentially, with a fair wind, deliver on it?
End of the year. End of the year with that fair wind.
And that's big. So what kind of recovery is Etihad seeing? Who is flying and where are they sitting?
Interestingly enough, premium has seen growth higher than economy. And what we're seeing is a significant growth in business leisure. And there's that term people are using, which I love, which is called revenge tourism. Yeah, and I think it's an element of that. Business travel is there and is starting to come back. And again, coming back rather quicker than I think a lot of pundits were predicting during COVID, during the pandemic. So, yeah, we're seeing strength across the aeroplane.
And I asked Terry about the challenges that it had faces in getting back to full speed.
Getting the aircraft that we want back in the air has not been such a challenge, because we were very careful about how we stored them and how we made sure they were ready. So there are two different types of storage. There's park them, where you keep them ready to fly any time, and then there's the storage where you put them away and you shut them down. It takes you months to bring them back. So we took a plan knowing that we'd have to bring some back, so we've been able to bring them back into the fold reasonably smoothly. We've had the same challenges as any other airline, or indeed businesses, had in terms of growth and getting people back into the system, but that's under control as well, and we're pretty confident that we can fly our plan effectively for the rest of the year.
What about the challenge of finding staff and the great resignation and what you have to pay them?
Tail end of last year, when the growth started, it was clear things were going to happen quicker than they were before. Then Omicron hit, and that sort of put a damper on it a little bit. But we started the process prior to that. And it's really in the larger manpower areas that you have the greatest challenge, which is cabin crew, ground staff, airport, etc. However, we put really good plans in place, and we've been able to attract what we want, even though we've had to work a lot harder to do it, because it has been a tougher marketplace to get people back.
Are you having to pay people more than you were pre-pandemic?
Not in a significant amount. No, I think it depends. Generally, it's pretty much where it was before COVID. There will be pockets across the airline where different skill bases, where it's supply and demand, isn't it? And you pay a little bit more for certain skills. But in general, no.
Well, we like to think of ourselves as the People's Business Show, and we took a couple of questions that listeners had asked about aviation in general, about airline recovery in general, and put them to Terry. Load factors, for example. Etihad's currently flying, as he said, there at 80-plus percent load factors. How do you keep flying pleasant with such full planes?
Well, that's been an aviation industry challenge forever, hasn't it? For me, the spirit always has been, it's how all the little bits come together. So ultimately, at the end of the flight, how does a customer feel about their journey? And that comes from all the elements. And yes, it is to do with the seat. Yes, it is to do with the product. A lot of it is to do about how the cabin crew interact and how they make you feel as well. So all of those elements have to come together there. And it's always been the challenge. There's nothing new in terms of full aeroplanes. It's just really good to be back there.
With full planes comes less upgrades, though, listeners have been pointing out about airlines in general. How do you keep a points program attractive and frequent flyers happy if they can't trade up for a better seat?
We know the challenge. It's again an industry challenge, but we make sure that we hold some of our seats available for upgrade. Whether that can satisfy the total demand or not, that's another matter, but we do. But it's something that you have to work with and make sure that, you know, in the peak of the peak, maybe it may not be there, but you make sure that you're keeping those seats available for the program overall. The other thing about a loyalty program is, of course, it's not just about seats. And it's about how you make your loyalty program relevant outside of that. So I don't know if you've heard of what we've been doing, where we have a program called Miles on the Go, for instance. So if you go into, say, Yas Mall in Abu Dhabi, and I was in there not long ago buying some children's gifts in Pottery Barn. I pop out of Pottery Barn because my Etihad Guest app and my Etihad Guest credit card are logged on my app. I come out and it says, you have just earned this number of miles, or would you like to pay your bill in miles that you've just been in the shop? And this is in shops, restaurants, all over the place. So you start making the currency relevant beyond travel. Now, of course, it will always be demand for seats. But what you also want to do is give choice and opportunity for people to use and engage. And I think one of the things that I'm particularly proud of during COVID is that we kept that program relevant. So aeroplanes weren't flying, but we could still engage and keep the loyalty program relevant.
And the other biggie, of course, that we've just been discussing with Paul Griffiths is ticket prices. Jet fuel around $142.50 a barrel. How does Etihad keep prices attractive?
Hey, it's business, it's supply and demand, it's cost, and when fuel goes up, and given the proportion of our cost that is fuel, we have to put fuel surcharges on. But we also need to remain competitive. So it's the forever balance we've had, making sure that the ticket prices are attractive enough to stimulate demand, but also we're sadly not a charity. We're here to make money as well.
So what kind of summer is Etihad projecting?
I think we're getting to some degree of stability now, notwithstanding the world events that are going on. Everything that we're looking at, on the basis that we don't get another major crisis worldwide somewhere, or something happens with COVID that suddenly shuts things down again, let's assume those don't happen, we're looking at a really positive summer. In fact, our forward bookings are looking incredibly healthy right now. And I don't think the fact that ticket prices do have to be slightly higher because of fuel price, that doesn't appear to be putting people off. I think people are just relieved that the restrictions to fly. You don't need a PCR test now. A number of destinations have stopped even needing vaccination, etc. It's now okay to travel. And therefore, I think the price sensitivity probably balances with, I'm going.
Terry Daly, Executive Director of Guest Experience at Etihad. If you go to our Instagram page, you can check out a video of our ATM adventures.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.